SBS Radio.
My name is Dr. Ray Hodson, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at New South Wales University. So the first trip was in 2010. And we've had on average three trips each year to Nepal to provide medical care and teaching of the local doctors and nurses and midwives. It began with a patient of my own here in Australia who wrote a thesis on uterine prolapse in Nepal. That was what she called a uterine prolapse in Nepal. And I said to her, well, why Nepal of all places? And she said, don't you realise there is more prolapse in Nepal than any other country? And I didn't know that. So I went over and worked out how we could do to help that, knowing that here in Australia there was a very common procedure that I performed. It was probably the commonest major operation that I performed in Australia. So I felt that we could provide some help to the women suffering with prolapse in Nepal. That's how things started.
Yep.
It was now 9 years ago.
For maybe someone who doesn't know exactly what uterine prolapse is, could you tell us what it is?
The term uterine prolapse, we are more likely to use the term pelvic organ prolapse or genital prolapse is a better term. And genital prolapse is the falling down of various pelvic organs into the vagina and beyond the vagina. So the main three pelvic organs that can fall out are the uterus and the bladder and the bowel in any combination, and sometimes all three. And that leads to all sorts of symptoms and signs and restrictions. It's quite an uncomfortable process, the severe prolapse, and it often leads to and associated with incontinence and pain with walking and painful sitting, and very difficult or often impossible to have intercourse. And it's a major problem for people, particularly in rural Nepal, which of course is where the bulk of the population live.
Why the significant number of women in Nepal suffer from this problem?
Yeah, and we are not clear as to the exact reasons why. We have some theories, and my own feeling is it's a combination of things. Women do carry a lot of heavy workloads. They carry not just at any time of the year, but even during pregnancy and during the postnatal period when their pelvic organs are most vulnerable. So there's a lot of extra pressure on the pelvic organs to create that that situation where they're vulnerable to prolapse. We know that a lot of women in Nepal have poor diets. They're malnourished, and particularly it seems lack of protein can lead you to be vulnerable to prolapse as well. It's clear also the more babies you have and the shorter spacing between them, the more likelihood you are to develop prolapse.
What about marrying young?
Yeah, we feel that's connected as well for two reasons. They're young, and the organs, pelvic organs, have not often developed fully anyway, and they're then suffering the traumas of pregnancy and childbirth. But if you add to that the fact that many of these children, and they are children, are malnourished, then the pelvic organs are even less developed than they would at that young age. So it's a double whammy, that effect. So there is no one's absolutely certain. It's very difficult to isolate one single cause for the prolapse, and it's most likely that it's a combination of things.
Yep. And tell us about the Australians for Women's Health, which was founded, I think, in 2010.
When I went over, well, firstly reading about it, and then went over to see the literally thousands and thousands of women suffering with this prolapse, we knew that something needed to happen. And initially, that was our principal aim, was to treat as many of these women as possible, try to find the cause as well. But our mission gradually evolved over the years. While we were over there performing our camps and treating these women and teaching the local doctors as well, we saw that a lot of mothers and babies were dying as well. There was a lot of maternal deaths and neonatal deaths in stillborn babies. And we realized that was another area of need in women's health. And so our mission was evolved then into not just treating women with prolapse and helping other doctors and medical staff learn about managing prolapse, but also to help with maternal care too. We felt that as a gynecologist, but we're trained as obstetricians as well, that we could have an impact there as well. Most of these conditions that led to maternal death and neonatal death are preventable conditions. Conditions like hemorrhage and high blood pressure and infection, things that we treat every day in Australia and we hardly give a second thought. But these people, particularly in rural areas and particularly when they were delivering in areas other than a hospital, were suffering and all too frequently dying as a result of that. So now we have two arms to our organisation, the management of prolapse and the management of maternal health.
Mm.
And there are regions of Australia, and particularly central Australia, where our perinatal mortality and our maternal mortality are concerningly high. But they are much lower than the condition, those conditions in rural Nepal. There are a number of doctors and allied medical staff working on those problems in Australia. We felt we would be able to have much more of an impact in a country like Nepal than in places like central Australia. Prolapse, uterine prolapse or genital prolapse, is not a major issue. It happens in parts of Australia. To some parts of Australia to a greater extent than others, but it has nowhere near the impact on the health, and the prevalence is nowhere near as great in any part of Australia than it is in Nepal.
Tell us about the book Heartbreak in the Himalayas. What made you write that book?
We would return from our few trips each year to Australia, having had quite a few adventures, and people seemed to be very interested in what we would do over there and the activities and the excitement and the heartbreaks and the joys that we would experience each time. I detected a lot of interest in what was happening, so I felt there was certainly a book in the making in putting these adventures to paper. And I thought to myself, if I was to put that together and sell that book, that the sales from that book could help the very people we're trying to help in Nepal. We are currently building a hospital in eastern Nepal, rural Nepal, in the east of Nepal, in Dolaka.
Mm. Oh, in Dolaka, is it? I was going to ask you which part of the country.
Dolaka, yeah. Near Cherikot, in Dolaka. And this is a mothers and babies hospital, and we've been raising money for this hospital for 3 years now. And I felt to myself, if the book was able to sell, every cent of profit from that, the sales of that book, could go to building this hospital in Nepal.
How big hospital are we talking?
So it's a 35-bed hospital.
Okay. Mm.
And will clearly be treating women with prolapse and managing pregnancies as well. But a major thrust, two other major thrusts of the hospital. The top level of the hospital will entirely be devoted to teaching doctors and medical students and midwives and physiotherapists, teaching the local people. The other thrust is the community medicine program. You can build a hospital and a lovely, well-equipped hospital, and you can staff it with well-trained doctors and midwives and nurses, but it won't necessarily mean that the people will come to the hospital for treatment. You are probably aware of the cultural problems that exist in rural Nepal, and that women will often not attend hospital for their pregnancy, for their childbirth. They will not attend the hospital even though they're suffering with quite severe prolapse. And the culture of Nepal, while it's enchanting, it's captivating, it's spiritual, it's also strangely harmful to women in many ways. And it's got this very unusual combination of good and bad, the culture of Nepal. We love it. It's one of the reasons that Nepal is such a popular place for tourists to visit, is that spiritual culture. They're peaceful, serene people.
Mm.
But the other side of that double-edged sword is there's a tremendous amount of patriarchalism in the country, and women are not often allowed to come to the hospital for treatment. And
usage of shamans, for example, or, you know, women having to walk for days to come to hospital, like yours, I guess. How much of that do you see as a problem during your work in Nepal?
Yeah, because we work in the remote areas of Nepal, it's a massive problem. In the city areas like Kathmandu and Pokhara, it's not a problem really at all. But in the rural areas where 80% of the population live, it's a massive problem. And there are still many areas, including some areas that we work, where people are more likely to attend a shaman before attending a health centre. And they're more likely to stay at home and be delivered by a traditional birth attendant than to come to hospital and be delivered by a skilled birth attendant. And it is a real problem, and we acknowledge it, and it's one of the major themes running through the book, is how do we tackle this problem of culture when we don't want the culture to totally change. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We want to retain the charming elements to the culture. But if we're trying to do the best thing we can for the health of women and babies, it's to change one element of that culture.
Mm.
And that, of course, leads to other issues. What right do we have as people from another country coming to Nepal and wanting to change elements of the of the custom? Do we have a right to do that?
So how do you balance that, like, in terms of, you know, what you want to do, what you want to achieve, and then, like you said, the cultural practices of the country? You can't just come in and say, hey, I'm going to change what you do, what your custom is. How do you balance that?
And it's a very good question. And the way we tackle it is that, as you know, the culture in Nepal is a collectivist culture. So if we say to an individual, you must change your cultural ways, we have virtually no chance of that. We have a much better chance to talk to groups of women, to have street plays, to put radio shows on, to get some of the local people on side so they themselves can spread the word to others. We have a group of women who are respected in the various villages that we go to, and we train them up on things like hygiene and things like the benefits of attending antenatal care in the hospital and being delivered by a school birth attendant. And we use those local women whom we get on side, local elders whom we get on side, to speak to the people through us rather than us directly speaking to people and trying to convert them ourselves.
Mm.
It is still a dilemma. We can be accused of cultural imperialism. Cultural imperialism because we're trying to change people's cultures into something more similar to ours. But I justify that because if... Perhaps I can put it this way. When we sit down with our volunteers before each camp, we sit down, we have a pep talk about the camp to come. And among the things I say to them are that we have no right to interfere with the culture of any other country we're going to. We have no right to interfere with the culture of Nepal, where we're going to next week. But then I say, very shortly after that, we should not allow the abuse of human rights.
Mm.
And that is the conflict. That is the dilemma. How do you marry those two things up if the culture does appear to be the abuse of human rights? Mm. It is not just me saying that. There are a number of human rights studies, United Nations studies, who describe the same situation, that as wonderful as the culture is, there are certain aspects which impair women's health and babies' health and add significant unnecessary risks to their life.
The heartbreak, as we talked about earlier, I know you've got a few examples in the book, but maybe if you can give us an example so people can understand the scale of the problems that you see.
Yes, we had our the day starts with us in the hospital where we assess literally hundreds of women who are waiting to see us for their various ailments, and they don't all have prolapse. And they hear about a free women's health camp, and they come along with all sorts of things and all sorts of women's problems, and there may be infections or pain and other issues, but the majority have severe prolapse. When we speak to them through the interpreters, we learn that these women, on average, have suffered with their prolapse for 7 years. That is the average number of years that the women have suffered with this. It's often commenced at an early age. Many of them have commenced in their 20s, and they've had to endure this prolapse and the smell and the urine loss and the humiliation and the social impacts of this this genital problem for many years. And they have said to us, we thought this was with us for the rest of our lives. We did not realize there was a way around this. But they also tell us that many of their friends back home in the village they've come from, they've often walked for some days to get to us, many of their friends suffer with the same condition but are too frightened to come to see us, or have not been allowed to come to see us because of sometimes the husband and sometimes the mother-in-law.
Mm.
We see women who have been thrown out of home because their husband... These women who live in the rural areas, or the adults generally who live in rural areas of Nepal, the big majority are subsistence farmers, and they rely on physical work to get food on the table. They can no longer work when they have severe prolapse, So the husband sees his wife, who is no longer able to help out physically on the farm. She's no longer able to satisfy him in bed. And so it's not a rare thing at all for these women to be cast out of their home. I must qualify this because we meet some wonderful husbands. The last thing I would want to do is damn men generally in Nepal. There's some outstanding husbands and supporting partners in Nepal. There's no doubt, but there's a significant proportion of these women who are cast out, and it's the physical impacts of severe prolapse are terrible, but the social and the emotional impacts are just devastating. Sometimes this is part of the heartbreak that we talk about in the book, what I often say is we wouldn't stand for these things in our own country. There'd be placards and marches in the street if the women's health was suffering anywhere near this degree. And I every bone in my body tells me that we shouldn't allow this to happen in other countries as well. And just because it's a long, long way away, it's on the other side of the world and it is a different culture, it's wrong. I believe it's morally wrong for us to turn our blind eye to that.
Tell us what you think. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.